And we are back. Thank you guys so much for sticking with us through the break. And want to get to our interview guest. He's one of my personal favorites. And I'm probably a little biased on that because he also happens to be a partner of mine. But want to welcome back Mr. Marcos Bueno to the show. Marcos, thank you for joining us.
Thanks to you, Zach. Always a pleasure. You know that.
Yeah, well, it's, you're one of the few people that says that, but I'll take it. Hey, anyway, wild ride we've been on here. You were posting, sent out your quarterly report to our clients. And for those of you that don't know, Marcos runs our algorithmic momentum portfolio. And not too shabby, pal, especially coming off last year. And let me set the stage a little bit for you. Since inception, this thing is absolutely ripped. You can give us the numbers. But again, like I was stating earlier on the show, the thing that was the most impressive to me was how that algorithmic portfolio played defense during last March. And then what further impresses me is the performance this year, because in terms of the outperformance of the S&P 500, it's not as nearly as drastic as it's been in the last couple of years. But this is an entirely different market than we've had the last couple of years. I've been surprised at the algo's ability to pivot, because I always thought that'd be kind of the weak spot. And that's okay. No portfolio is perfect. But, you know, it's pivoted. And you're right at market performance the year after blowing them out the previous 2 years. It's pretty impressive. Congratulations. And
thank you.
I've been a benefactor, as well as our clients have, of that portfolio. But why don't you kind of explain to us, we got off to a little bit slower of a start, and then that momentum portfolio, she just came right back, and now here she is again. What do you attribute the success to? And then, again, go through the performance numbers. Tell us how that thing's done since inception to date and this year and last year and all that kind of stuff. And then let us know kind of what you're thinking about it as the guy that built this and, you know, kind of where you see us headed.
Sure. So just to give you a quick overview, so this portfolio started in May of 2019. Mm-hmm. Since then, it has doubled this month. So it's 100% up since May 2019. From May to December 19, it was up 29%. Full year 2020 was up 28%, that kind of thing. I'm speaking from memory.
And then this year, it was actually just shy of 30, but just shy, like 29.8 or something like that.
29.8, yeah. And then this year so far, I think we're just shy of 20 in the first 8 months. So that compounded adds up to 100%, which is much better result than I ever expected. And to answer the second question is, why has it been flexible? Why has it been adapting to different markets? And the answer to that is that it's created based on sort of like timeless features, what I call timeless features of the equity markets. Stocks, like stocks, have always some winners and losers. It's very hard to say ex ante, like a priori, which are going to be the winners and losers. But no matter what market we are in, there is always some winners and there's always some losers. So what happens in many portfolios is that they make they put themselves in a bucket or a certain mandate or whatever, some restrictions that they benefit when their mandate is doing well. And when markets change and then a different kind of mandate is working, then the other guys do well and they don't do as well. I started this with a completely agnostic perspective as to sectors, factors, trading styles. I just wanted to be on whatever the winners are at any given time. So I designed a system that does exactly that. It's like, it just has no preconceived ideas of what should work, other than it sort of like finds out the things that are working and it latches onto them. So it's a trend following system. It finds the trends, and trends tend to be persistent because that's why they are trends. Trends are sort of like the result of change in life, and change tends to be, takes time. And then when we go to from A to B, we don't go in one go, in one step. There's multiple steps in between, and that creates a trend. So when you see a trend, chances are it's going to continue. So what it does, it just finds the trends and it just latches onto them until they stop. And that means that it's completely agnostic to market regimes. Just whatever trend is happening, it will be on it. And that's why when in 2019 and most of 2020, it was tech. 2020 was a lot of healthcare that was working. This year, it's been less clear. That's why the performance is very good, but it's not double the S&P like it was 2 years before, because the market has been less clear about what the trends are. But still, it got on the consumer discretionary trends for most of the year, some of the industrial trends in the first half of the year. Now it's moving away from that because that seems to be like a little bit weaker. And in the last couple of months, it's been getting on tech, which it seems to be what's working now. So that's why he's like, it doesn't matter what the market is. It just follows this very simple process conceptually. It's not that easy. It's subtle to implement, but the concept is quite easy. It's simple. And that's why it's robust.
Yeah. Well, and then the other, obviously, you know, you're talking to the leader of riskmanagement.com. We don't really have that thing, but, you know, it's Know Your Risk Rater. We're always talking about the risk management side of it. And one of the
things. That's the other thing. It's like,
That's the other, in my opinion, that's the most compelling part of the story. And that's honestly, as a guy that partnered with you and believed in it from the beginning, even that part of it has surprised me, that ability for it to capture that upside and yet how beautifully it held up during the biggest realized volatility scare in the history of the market.
Yeah, the risk management side is actually the harder part. That's where experience comes in. And so like, knowing what you do matters. So it's portfolio construction. How do you make sure that your positions are the right ones in terms of not just in an individual basis, but relative to the rest of the portfolio in terms of correlation? And then when to pull the plug on a position? That's the other thing that is not an easy to. It's easy to say. It's hard to decide what that is and then do it. So that is another part that is very important too. And it's so important that we could actually pick random stocks and we would still make money. Less money, it will take longer and stuff, but I think it will still work.
Well, because this is something I was hammering on again earlier too, because it protects against the downside, and it's, you know, I don't know how you feel about it. You interface a lot less with retail, you know, investors, and a lot of people on the professional side too, right? Investing comes all down to what stocks you picked, and you go, that's actually not the way that it works, right? How much you lose on your losers is probably a bigger defining factor on your total return than even which ones you get right, right?
Look, let me tell you a story. This is something I did for me at the beginning. It was not meant to be offered to anybody else. It was just for me. And my number one rule or criteria, the thing that I didn't want to, is to own something that was going down. It's like, okay, what is, if I were to boil it down to one thing, it's like, I don't want to own something that is going down. I'd rather be in cash, not invested, rather than do something that is going down. So if we find ourselves in a market where there are no stocks that are going up, everything is going down, there are no winners, everybody's losing, then we will be in cash. We will not be invested. It's just much better to be in cash than losing money. So that's the principle. That's why when the market goes down, it's so quick and getting out.
Yeah, and it
so
was.
The story I wanted to tell you is that I was speaking to an institutional allocator last week or the week before, and I say this, like, you know, I don't own anything that is going down. And he said, well, it's hard to go broke like that. And I said, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it is. It's hard to go broke like that. The other thing that I think is really remarkable is how well it has played with the value portfolio, the way they've pivoted off each other. It's just been a revelation, man. And I have not said this, but to that tune, I think this is as good a place to announce it as any. We're going to be launching that portfolio in an ETF that will be widely available. You're going to get a better deal if you go through us, obviously. But we're getting ready for the big time, aren't we, pal?
We are. It's a long process, so it's not an overnight thing that's going to happen. But we have been putting a lot of hours behind that project, and it's going. So there will be more soon.
Risk management for the people, man. We're democratizing risk management. That's the way I like to look at it. Okay, so fantastic performance, and from you to me, thank you, because it's been a wonderful addition to our suite of offerings, and it's become a core thing that we do. And I have a feeling there are going to be a lot of other investors very soon that are going to be saying the same thing. Now, moving over to the rest of the markets, this has been, you and I were talking earlier today about what a knife fight this has been. It's been somewhat of an exhausting four-month run, just seeing things wash back and forth. Looking back at the market, what are you seeing right now? A lot of talk. We did a segment earlier in the show today about a lot of talk about market crashes. You're hearing all the perma bears come out saying again, things about to get nasty. I really don't see that. You can feel free to disagree with me. How are you reading things? What are you seeing?
I don't necessarily disagree with people that are negative, because I think that there are things that you can pick in the market that are negatives. Mm-hmm. So if you get focused on that, I think that you can make an argument that things are dangerous. And it's not unreasonable to think that. I think there is a huge concentration of risk in a handful of names, mostly so like the big super mega tech names, like Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Google. They have been the big drivers of the performance this year. So it has worked on the way up. But at the same time, if these guys weaken, the whole market will weaken, even though maybe the majority of the companies are doing well. This year, at least until a month ago, many companies were not doing well. I mean, most stocks were going down. And yet the market was going up because the big mega caps that had the big weights were going up. So the market was going up. So there's been a lot of frustration there. And if you say, okay, not that many stocks are going up, that means that the breadth is kind of weak. We're very depending on the performance of a handful of stocks. So I think that you can say, yeah, it's a dangerous territory. And in my letters, I've been writing about that lately, let's say in the last month or so. I think that the market is in a more solid footing. We have seen more names performing. I think the good performance is a bit more broad-based. So that is positive for the market. That, again, that doesn't mean that the indices are going to keep going up, because it depends on those 5, 6, 10 names. But it's less likely to crash if the good performance is widespread. What I can think can happen is before here and the end of the year is that we got another moment of, yeah, like a gut check. Given how negative people are right now, it may not happen right now. It may happen in a month from now. I don't see anything that is super dangerous right now. Valuation is another thing that people are saying, you know, things are expensive and stuff, but I'm not sure I believe that. I think there's been so much money pumped into the economy that everybody has money. So many businesses are looking for new employees, looking to hire people. I see everything kind of full. So there's not a real lack of money out there. So earnings have been very good. They've been catching up to expectations. So I don't think that is a real danger right now.
Hold on. Now, I mean, okay, valuate, and I tend to agree with you. I don't think that valuations as a whole, considering the backdrop that we've got, I don't think that they're unrealistic. But comparatively speaking, historically,
and
valuations are sky high.
They are high, and there are pockets that are like stupid. But they're not. I mean, we need to compare. Valuations are very hard to compare looking back.
Mm-hmm.
Because it depends on the context on the day. We need to think about what people can do with their money, right?
Right.
So,
in an environment where cash costs you 5% a year, it's kind of hard to say that the market trading at a 40 price to earnings ratio, right? In that context, treasuries paying 1.3, cash paying -5. Probably hard to make an argument that it is really overvalued right here, right?
Yeah. So, what are you going to do with the money?
Right.
So, yeah, valuations are higher than they were in the past, but it's extremely attractive versus your other alternatives today. Like, you cannot invest in the market 10 years ago. You need to compare about what you can do today or like what's going to be looking forward. So compared to today, equities is one of the most attractive areas. Like, I can tell you something, like we're working with one of our prime brokers. I cannot tell you the pricing exactly because we under confidentiality stuff. But basically, if we have cash, they take a spread over the overnight banking funding rate. That rate is around 7 basis points, and they want to have a cut. That means that if we have cash with them, we will pay them.
Right, right.
So that is the institutional money markets, right? It's like any institution that has cash, basically, either you put in money market funds or you pay to hold it somewhere that is like another money market fund. So compared to that, equities, that yeah, they're risky, but you can get a dividend, you can get growth, you can stuff. It's like, it's not that bad a choice. So that's why valuations is like, okay, you know what? It was higher than before, but I'd rather own an equity that pay my bank to hold my cash.
Well, and there's another interesting thing too. If people are worried about headline valuations, I get it, but I also run a value fund, and so I'm focused on that side of it. This whole idea that it's all widespread and all over the place. I mean, we've got several stocks in the portfolio that are trading below 10 price to earnings ratio, throwing off 5% dividends. You know, so if you have a valuation fear, there are places to go. You know, companies that are growing, companies that are doing well. Now, it's hard to explain from where I sit the valuation spread, right? It seems as if you have any kind of link to tech at all, right? Your valuation is naturally just going to go up. But there are pockets of craziness, but there are pockets of just dirt cheap out there, isn't there?
Yes, yes. I mean, you had the, you still have it, I think, the Peabody trade, right?
Yeah.
When
yeah.
That thing was throwing like 100% free cash flow at current coal prices, right? So yeah. If coal prices stay constant for a year, these people generate their market cap. Like, that's not expensive.
Well, yeah, but Marcos, no one's going to use coal. Coal's going away in 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, because people are moving herds, and this is kind of the inefficiencies out there. That's coming from the institutional money side, where in the same way that they fall in love with tech or software as a service last year or whatever because it's cool and you must have it, or green energy, and people say they want to talk about having it invested to their clients. And that happens a lot on the warehouses, by the way. It's like they say, oh, we have this green stock, so we're going to get you, this is the future. So everybody goes there, and then they take all the money out of the things like coal and gas and oil. And you know what? That means that these are dirt cheap assets because this inefficiency out there. It's not that they don't know. It's that there are other forces that are making them take those decisions that are not driven by making money.
Right.
It's a different, their utility function is not just their returns, it's also the stories they want to tell. But that, for people that don't have those kind of constraints, that they only care about producing returns, it's a good opportunity. It's a danger too, by the way. It's a danger too, because when things look cheap and these guys are still taking money out of it, they can run you over, right? You say, this is cheap, I'm going to buy it, but they keep selling, and then you go under with them. So that's also a risk.
Yeah.
We've seen that, it's like.
Well, that reminds me of a tweet I put out this week. Somebody was like, hey, what was your worst investment decision ever? And I said, buying something that was really cheap without the realization that it could get a whole lot cheaper, right?
Yeah, because it cuts both ways, right? In the sense that when you have players that are not driven by, let's call it, fundamentals, that get things out of line relative to fundamental value, that means that your fundamental analysis may be completely worthless, because there are other players out there that are much bigger that do not care about that. So you say, yeah, this is cheap from a fundamental perspective, but it doesn't matter because those other guys keep selling it regardless. So that gives you the opportunity, but that also gives you the risk. So it really cuts both ways.
Yeah, no, it's a different play. Now, again, I know this isn't exactly what you're focused on, but you've got quite the experience on the commodities desk in trading commodities. What do you
most
see?
Of my career was in commodities. So.
Right. What do you see in commodity land? Because again, in the value portfolio, we've got a pretty good allocation there. What do you see in commodity land and for oil and that gas? How are you reading that whole sector?
Okay. First caveat is that I don't follow it as closely as I used to a few years ago. So I don't have any particular insight into any of them. From a big picture perspective, anything that is generates carbon, like energy, like oil, gas, coal, that kind of thing, is being hammered because of the ESG concerns, especially on the equity side, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to be seen as buying anything that generates carbon. That's why Peabody was so interesting, and that's why some of the energy names have been so interesting, and I think they will continue to be interesting, albeit a little bit dangerous because of that, right? But what this means is that nobody's investing in new capacity. It's a bit an exaggeration, but there's not enough investment in new capacity. Coal is actually one of the most glaring ones. It's like, who is out there wanted to invest in new coal mines? It's like very hard. Like
this guy you're talking to.
you want to buy the stock, but when it comes to okay, who's going to finance a new mine?
Oh yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Where is the money coming? Like, if you are a loan officer, or you're like an Australian bank or a Canadian bank or a US bank, and say, yeah, we are investing into the development of new mines in Australia or in Wyoming or whatever, you're gonna have a mob outside your offices. Literally, it's just gonna make you look bad. So nobody wants to do that. So that means that there is no money for new development. Like. And that, what does that mean is that because we're not really changing our behavior as a society, we're still consuming energy. Like, emerging market is consuming a lot of coal in the U.S. and the West is consuming a lot of energy. I mean, everybody talks about climate change, but nobody's really changing behavior, right?
California out today, news is to deal with rolling blackouts, they're going to burn more fossil fuels. California.
That's another story that we can talk about, that how there's been misdirection in, like, misallocation of in terms of power generation, but in terms of producing the coal and basically the raw materials, there hasn't been any investment because it looks bad on people that do that. So and since demand has not really changed because we haven't changed our behavior, then there's not enough supply to meet the demand, and then the price goes higher. I mean, there's sort of like, so it's volatile. It goes up and down, but that's the direction. Equities, again, is tricky because you have all these flows that are uneconomic, and also because they're not investing, the companies are not growing beyond price. So it's hard to be excited about growth prospects. That can change one day, but for now, it's a little tricky. Though the price drivers will be there, I think. Now, there are other commodities, uranium. Right?
Yeah.
That seems to be a bit more advanced in that dynamic, in which uranium got out of shape and like out of favor a decade ago. So there hasn't been any investment in new production for many, many, many years. And we're getting close to crunch time. And again, so there's no money flowing into the space, but that money is only going to produce results 10 years from now. So uranium is a commodity that has buyers that are completely price insensitive, because when you run a nuclear plant, the cost of uranium is not really a factor. It's like, you need it. There's no other way around it. If you had to turn it off, it's a complete disaster. So whatever price of uranium is, so it is. And it's only just of the overall cost of running a nuclear plant, the actual cost of uranium is just not really that big. So whatever the price is, it is. So, and there's not enough, then they will pay up and up and up and up until Somebody says, you know what, it's so high, it's like 10 times higher than it is now, so maybe I shut out the plant. So, but we're far away from that. So that has potential. In agricultural land, I think that the weather, climate has been a little bit more extreme than it has been in the past. And that creates complications. And that means that grains and stuff needs to be moved around from different places. That puts strains in supply chains. I think shipping, again, has issues. So it's expensive to move things from one place to the next. That also has upward pressures in commodities in food and agriculture. Other metals like copper, aluminium, similar dynamic. I'm not following the metal markets that closely, so I'm not going to make a comment just in case I make a fool of myself there, but it's similar, right? Mm-hmm. Especially copper. Copper,
I like uranium. Copper.
Yeah, I used to like it a lot. Now I like it a little less because there's no mine supply. There's no primary supply because it's just doing a copper mine is extremely complicated. And it's just there's not that many more deposits. But there's a lot of copper on the ground, pipes, old houses, recycling, scrap. And if prices go up and up, high up, then we're going to see people recycling the metal because the metal is up there. So it's like instead of having mines digging out of the ground, it's kind of a big city like New York, for example, can be a copper mine via scrap. So I think that we've been there. The thing about scrap is also limited. So once that is over, then the prices has to take another step higher. I don't know when that can happen. I really don't have. I'm not close enough to know that.
I saw, speaking of copper, I saw in action the other day, I saw the most brilliant low-cost copper investment I've ever seen in my life. And it is only possible here in the great state of Washington and Oregon and maybe a couple other places. But some meth heads went in with a grocery cart into Lowe's Hardware, loaded the sucker up with copper and walked out the front door because they made sure to not steal more than $2,000 of copper. But I sat there and I thought that there, if we could get this cat off the drugs, he'd probably be a great portfolio manager because he's the only guy I know that's got a position in copper and his cost basis is zero. Have you seen any of those videos? Have you heard about what's going
no.
on here?
No.
Because they passed a new rule that says if somebody is stealing from a store in Seattle, they can steal up to $1,000 and they are in no danger of being prosecuted. And
that's a good business model.
Great business model. I mean, the cost structure of that is phenomenal. I mean, those guys, they're going to be like the Hunt brothers of copper.
Yeah. No, but jokes aside, I mean, that's a real source of supply, right?
Yeah, truly, because they're going to turn around and sell it.
And we have seen people literally stealing copper garters out of houses, right?
Yeah.
Now what happens is that somebody come to a weekend house, vacation house, that they take your gutters away, copper, that like a few $1,000 of copper, that goes into the market as supply. Now, the person that owns the house is not buying that copper again. They're going to do like aluminum gutters or other like plastic, right? So that is a source of supply. We have seen people stealing cables and wires. Most of that sort of cancels each other when people had to rebuy it, but a lot of copper that gets thrown away, then it gets recovered out of cars and appliances, old houses, those kind of things.
But if you're gonna have this consistent demand by way of the automobile industry for, you know, and I want to look at the numbers, and it's right in there, but I want to say that the average EV, and by some accounts, they expect this number to go higher, is requiring 5 to 6x the amount of copper that it required for a traditional car. And so my thought is, if you have this unbelievably powerful new demand source, it seems to me that the whole recycling thing, while that could dampen the price of copper a little bit, isn't it's too inconsistent, isn't it, to supply an industry like the U.S. automobile or the world automobile industry? I mean, it just seems to me that it would be too lumpy to think that recycled or repurposed copper could make up that shortfall.
It probably won't. It probably won't. But there is, like, scrap supply doesn't come in unless you reach you hit a certain price point, right? Because auto is an expensive operation. But when you hit that point, it's really easy to source the copper, right? It's quick.
Like, that's true.
A mine is cheaper, but it takes longer, so the price can do anything in the meantime. Scrap supply is much higher in cost, but it's kind of easy to turn on, right? It's like, because the copper is already there. You don't have to wait 10 years to dig a big hole in the ground. But again, it's limited. There are some, but once that is exhausted, then if demand keeps growing, then price needs to give another price higher to get copper from some other higher cost places. And yet the EV stuff is a big demand driver. Definitely EV cars have a lot more copper. And not just that, is that electric vehicles increase the demand of power. That means that more power plants needs to be built, either conventional fossil fuel like natural gas or nuclear or wind. And all those things need generators, because ultimately that's what it is, that consumes a lot of copper. And more importantly, though, you need wires, you need transmission lines to take that power from whatever is generated to the towns. That is all copper. And actually, the Algo has a company that builds power transmission lines.
And oh, really?
So we have one of those. It's been identified as a winner in this environment, and this company, they just build transmission lines, which is interesting, right?
Wild, yeah. Hey, switching to a different one. I don't know if you've done any digging into this one, but it's interesting to me on a bunch of different levels. Have you looked at Nat Gas at all?
I used to be a minor expert in Nat Gas. I don't know anything today. Let's put it that way.
Well, I know, but you've got to have some thoughts.
I really don't. I really don't. Sorry.
It's such an interesting one to me, and we've got very small, yeah, very conservative positions in a couple plays involved in Nat Gas, but anecdotally, one of the first things that drew me to it is, I think we all know the story behind Nat Gas. I think in 2007, I think you were trading right around $13 a cubic foot. You got down as low as like 190 something a cubic foot. Now you've rebounded a little bit, but you're still way off the previous highs. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, the biggest reason for that was the U.S. shale movement, right? They were just pumping out natural gas as a byproduct that virtually cost them nothing. And a lot of those guys were just burning the natural gas off because it wasn't even profitable to get it to the wellhead. Is that the chief weight on natural gas over this cycle?
I would say yes. I mean, I can sort of like go over some generalities without really getting into the weeds, because I'm not familiar with the market today. But definitely associated gas, which is the name for sort of like gas as a byproduct of oil production. When fracking started, they would produce a lot of gas, right? So that gas was a byproduct. It was not really needed. There was an excess gas. There was no LNG facilities out of the U.S. to export gas outside. So the gas was trapped domestically, and there was more gas than was needed. So gas prices went down. Basically.
Yeah.
Now, in the last few years, now we have LNG terminals that can export, that can balance the market in the U.S. Because in Asia, where most of the LNG is consumed, that has always been $10 plus, right? Coming out of Australia, coming out of Qatar, being sent to Japan and China, and also Europe. That was a very expensive market. The U.S., was when these guys were paying 10, the U.S. was trading at 1, but there was no way to move the gas out of the U.S. into those markets. When LNG facilities came along, then there was an avenue to do that. So that basically increased the demand of gas domestically in the U.S., and that pushed price higher. Now, because of what we were talking about, lack of investment in oil, oil also suffered in price. Fracking companies and E&P like producers have been a lot more disciplined in their production, and a lot of them actually went out of business. So also that cut the number of producers. So they've been a lot more disciplined, and so there's been a lot less associated gas, and the market has balanced a lot. So that means prices are going up. Now, this is a very big picture. Now, I'm not following, again, day to day, but that's the big picture. Whether that continues or not, I don't know, but there is no reason to why we would have $10 gas in Japan and $6 gas in the U.S. if we can move the gas. So
yeah, again, this isn't a recommendation that for anybody listening. That's why we have light positions on that stuff. It just, I think one of the things that attracts to me to it is it's almost become like a throwaway item. You know, and if you've got this big push for green energy, not if we do, we've got this big push for green energy. It just smacks of lunacy to me to not have nuclear number one and nat gas as a serious part of that transition. Right. And I get people saying that it's still a fossil fuel, but as a transition commodity, it makes all the sense in the world. Right. I mean, What other fossil fuel can you burn in your kitchen all day long and suffer no degradation of air quality?
I mean, gas is clean. That's obvious.
Yeah.
There are two problems, I think. I mean, one of the things that suffered with the green movement was nuclear, because a lot of the green supporters were anti-nuclear. I disagree with that position. I think nuclear is excellent.
Yeah.
But at the same time, do I want to have a nuclear plant in my backyard? It's like, not really, right?
Yeah,
so it's a tricky problem to solve. Because even the people that say we should have more nuclear, reality is that we don't really want to have a nuclear plant next to our home, right? So that applies to everybody across. So where do you put them? That's a problem. Even though it makes sense, I mean, it doesn't make sense to close the ones we have. That's for sure. But when it comes to building new ones, it's also a tricky problem because do you want a nuclear plant next to your home? It's tricky, right?
Yeah, but have you heard about how they're pushing forward? And Buffett was wrapped up in this somehow, but they're pushing forward on these smaller, more you know, much more regional type plants that won't take up nearly as much room. So maybe you have more of them in smaller.
Yes.
That seems like a logical way forward.
I completely agree, and I think it's potentially a viable solution. Again, this is not an overnight thing either, because these things take a lot of time. The time is longer than the political cycle, right?
Yeah.
So that's a mismatch there that makes it very difficult. I think there is this emotional reaction towards nuclear energy, and it's scary. And
it's also changing the face. And to pull first full circle on you, Marcos, and loop this back into the ESG thing, it also, to me, these factors are kind of changing the face of investing. And I wanted to come back to ESG, but if the ESG movement... So first of all, I'd like to hear what your opinions on the ESG movement are, because I kind of have two forms of thought on that. One part of me thinks it's, you know, to steal a really popular and overused phrase from the Fed. Part of me thinks that this whole ESG move could be kind of transitory, right? Just a popular wave of the time. And then part of me thinks that it could be here to stay and it could get some serious traction. The only thing about it is, if you start getting these ESG mandates, there aren't enough truly ESG companies out there to invest in. So I don't really know how this is going to play out. So I guess my question would be this. Do you think this ESG thing with us, would you put it in the same bucket you did, right? Meaning if the political winds change, is the ESG just going to become another fad that really never took place? Do you think it's here with us to stay? If so, what kind of impacts do you see it having?
I think it's going to be hard to move away from it. Really. Because who will be the first to move? I think that there is a – let me tell you my opinion on ESG. I think ESG, like value investing, makes sense. The problem is that it's been polluted or contaminated by fake ESG. Yeah, yeah, bastardized, exactly. That's by fake ESG, right? Where it's just a label, it's a pretend thing, it's like greenwashing, it's like it's not real. It's just put on a label, charge the investor double the price, and everybody's happy, but nothing's really changing. Now, you can think about ESG done the right way, saying, okay, I have a certain principle that I want to live by, and I'm willing to take a lower return to feel good about it, because I'm investing in things that other people will not invest because they don't return enough, but I am okay with that. I think that's valid.
Do you think a lot of investors are going to make that choice?
No, ESG is being sold as a high return.
Yeah, and that ain't happening.
No, that's not happening, because if that were the case, there will not be such a thing as ESG.
Yeah, right.
It will be best practice. It will be like good investing, right? ESG, per se, works as a label because it allows people to get lower returns. And there are things like, say, let's make this investment that will be good for society. It will not be good for me as an investor or as good at other choices that I may have, but I want to do it because I think it's the right thing to do, and I'm willing to take a lower return for it. That's what ESG is, and I think it's valid. It's a valid perspective. But now that an investor makes on its own, right? Like, yeah, I think this is it brings me happiness to do this. I think it's a good thing to do. So I'm willing to take a lot of return.
You know, I hadn't thought about that aspect of it, but, and I don't mean to interrupt you, and I hope you don't lose traction, but you make a brilliant point, because one of the things that I've been thinking about is, who are these investors rolling into this? Like, why would it? And you just said it. What a brilliant money management strategy. They're going to charge them more and not have to keep up with the market.
Exactly. Right? Like,
they're going to get paid for no alpha.
So like, ESG, as you said, has been bastardized as a way to extract more fees from the client for lower performance.
Yeah.
That's the scam. That's the part of ESG that I do not like. That it has become, to a great extent, a scam. And that ultimately, I think that's going to kill it. Now, a good investor does not need to have anybody saying this company has good governance. If you're a good investor, you're going to check that, and you're not going to invest in a company that has bad governance, because that will be bad investing. You will actually be a bad investor if you invest in a company with bad governance. Same with sustainability. It's like, if you're not a sustainable company, I'm not investing in you. The E, the environmental impact, that's a little bit more debatable, because there's a lot of externalities that are impacted there. So maybe you're damaging to society as a whole, but because of externalities, but because you don't pay for those externalities, your return is actually pretty good. That's the only thing that is debatable. Well, the other two is not, they shouldn't even exist. I mean, like, good investing already incorporates that.
Right.
So that's the problem with ESG. Is that it's just nothing like what the original idea was.
Yeah. Well, and there's just, yeah, it's...
It just became a fee-pumping scheme.
Yeah, and we'll justify the higher fees because we're saving the world one trade at a time, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And which is not really true. It's just, that's the scammy part of it.
Yeah, but I mean, like I said, I mean, it's a brilliant business model in terms of, you know, if you don't have any ethics, you know, or any real commitments to your clients, it's not a bad way to gin up some good. Like I said, you get paid like you're running a hedge fund, and you perform like you're
like you're a charity.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like I said, not bad work if you can get it. No, that's kind of my the other issue with ESG is there is so much vitriol among that group of investors or even those people that are really pushing the ESG thing. There's so much vitriol to the fossil fuel producers, and yet some of those fossil fuel producers are the biggest investors in clean energy, right? Like, ConocoPhillips is one of them. Chevron's making a ton of investments in green energy. How do ESG investors square that, right? Public enemy number one for them are also the companies that are pouring the most into green energy technologies.
Can I pick a better example?
Yes.
Our friend Tesla. Right? Oh, Tesla is sort of like the prototypical ESG company, and yet it couldn't be less ESG if they tried.
Right? On any of the factors, not on even environmental.
Neither E nor S nor G. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's remarkable.
Let's start with the easy one. The governance. This is a company that has the of all the large companies, the least good, the worst, basically the worst governance. It's just a governance disaster. I mean, just that, it should eliminate it from any ESG kind of portfolio. Just that.
Yep.
Sustainability is not profitable. It's not interesting. They don't treat well their employees. They pay badly. They don't have any moral principles. Nothing.
And let's get it 2 or 3 years down the road. How many wasted dead batteries per year are they going to be responsible for putting in landfills?
Yeah, and on the environmental side, it's also a disaster. Like, if you are somebody that wants to save the planet, you focus first of all in consuming less energy. You don't do performance cars. You don't do cars that. That goes 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds. You mostly that weighs 3 tons, and you don't do batteries that weigh 2 tons that had, like, I don't know how much metals that are, like, as you say, copper and stuff that are hard to mine, and they're like, use tons of chemicals. You do small batteries, cars that can go 50 miles a day just to commute, that are small, that use little energy. You don't do performance car with super big tires, super weight, like, it has use tons of steel, tons of metals, tons of glass, use I don't know how much emissions. Like, come on.
What's the number? I saw a stat the other day, and it could be a little higher, could be a little lower, but something like 40% of the Teslas sold in the United States, 70% of the Teslas sold, no, like 85% of the Teslas sold in China. When you plug them in, the electricity's coming from coal-fired power plants.
That on top, right? That I didn't even go into the debatability of whether electric vehicles are good or bad in terms of emissions. There are different opinions and they can be defended, but the rest is not environmentally friendly. Tesla in particular.
Yeah, but
it doesn't have the S, and it doesn't have the governance. And yet all the ESG guys saying Tesla is the prototypical ESG company.
It's their top holding.
Yeah, and it's just a veneer, right? It's just they don't even want to look under the hood because if they did, they will realize that it's not ESG and the whole thing will come down, crashing, right? So just not even oil companies that you can say, okay, I don't want to do oil, but it's like the things that you are doing are the opposite of what you say you are doing. It's just like it's a farce.
It's very Muskian. You know what I mean? This is right up his alley. If he leaves Tesla, I'm convinced it'll be to start an ESG investment company. I mean, it's hand in glove, isn't it?
You might be right. I don't know. I haven't thought about that. I think that my personal opinion is that he wants to somehow monetize all these billions that he has and then sayonara.
Well, I mean, Lord knows if he hangs around long enough, all those billions will be a lot less billions eventually. Of course, I don't even want to get in that conversation. we both have battle scars from that one. Okay, so on another note, What do you see happening? Do you think that we've got more juice coming out of this? While we're sitting here talking, I was looking at the caption of an interview that was done with the president of the San Francisco 49ers. And he was saying that demand is off the chart for tickets. They've never seen demand this high for tickets, despite the Delta variant. Part of me sits there. When I'm looking at this whole backdrop, I really don't think that a new Delta variant, a new mask mandate, I think people are done with lockdowns. They're going to go out. They're going to spend money. I think you're going to see increased economic momentum going into next year because of that. How long it lasts, I don't know. But I don't really see, you know, another lockdown coming. I think people are tired of it. They want to get out. They want their lives to go on. How are you reading that?
I think that there are two things going on. One is sort of actual happening, and then another one is change of mentality of people. I think the first one is people are catching up with life, right? For a year or so, we have all been running slow, and there's like we need to catch up with life, right? We need to do things that we wanted to do but we couldn't. I think that there is pent up demand from that. I think people catching up with it. Plus, they have been giving. There's all these stimulus going, child credit, unemployment, all the stimulus checks. So people are feeling flush and with willingness to spend. I think that's actual. And I also think that there is a little bit of change of mentality, a little bit harder to demonstrate, but I think it's happening. And is people are YOLOing.
Oh, yeah.
I think that we have realized that as a society that life is short, and then you we're here for a limited period of time, and then you got to live. That coupled with now, I think that many people are thinking, why should I save any money? Like, why should I save? Yeah, why should I limit myself when if things go bad, the government is going to send me a check? Like, I don't need to save anymore. So to some extent, in the same way that equity investors have been talking about the Fed put, saying if the market goes down, the Fed is going to come in and bail the market out so I can be more invested. It's go now to the man on the street. It's like, you know what? If there is a recession, things go down. They'll send me a check just for free, right? So I can be a little crazier.
Well, and it's funny you say that, because one of the things that I've been thinking about, and we've talked about this before, is that I think one of the unintended consequences of what the government did, and by that, you know, I want to be clear, you know, I think it's a bit of a, again, logical fallacy to sit there and rip the government for financial irresponsibility based what they've done over the last year and a half. Now, I think it's irresponsible, but I also think in a lot of ways it was required due to the draconian measures they took to lock down the entire economy, in the sense that I don't really see it so much as handouts up until this point as I see it as the government paying damages. You know, I think that they were obligated to open up the treasury.
I do think so too. Yeah. Let's say there was a car crash and the patient needed intensive care unit, right?
Yeah.
So you needed to give it whatever it needed. Now the government is not bad at doing that. What they are bad at is just like sending the patient home when it's healed, right?
Right. Well, and this was my point, is I think one of the unintended consequences of it is what we've lived through now over the last 2 years. And we'll see if this plays out. But I just don't think recessions and market crashes are any longer politically feasible. And I think we've set that precedent.
I kind of agree with that. I think that market sell-offs are really not acceptable politically. And I think recession's the same. And the moment things weaken a little bit next time, I can tell you everybody's going to... In Washington, they immediately going to send people's checks.
Yep.
I think that's going to be the dynamic going forward, until the point where that's no longer possible, and then
it's kind of like the medical. It's kind of like the medical industry. I feel like what they did over the last year and a half is that they made handouts in the event of unfortunate economic outcomes. They've made that kind of the new standard of care, right? That medical term, the standard of care, right? The standard of care dealing with recessions is going to be to send out checks from now on. You know,
absolutely. And I think people, even many that cannot articulate it that way, they sort of feel it. That's why they're crazier now. Like, I don't need to save anymore. I don't need to be conservative in my investments because I'm going to be bailed out. I think that's permeating the whole society. And that's a dangerous thing in the long run. In the short run, it's hard to call it. But it's a bad dynamic, right?
Yeah. It's just such a bizarre environment, man. It is just so, and I know that's not really adding any value to the conversation. It's just crazy. You know, you spend so much of your life, and I know you're in the same shoes. You know, we've spent so much of our life and dedicate so much learning and time and money to studying this. And then, you know, and being hip deep in it and dedicating our lives to it. Right in front of us, just in this last cycle, all the rules have been completely flipped on their ear. You know, it's just it's a strange place to be.
Yeah. Over time, I realized that the business of investing is about most of it psychology of the players. And we are all players, politicians, the man on the street, we as professionals. And it's about the incentives and sort of like how they operate. Like the ESG is a question of psychology too. It's like people do this way because psychologically that's how it works. That's the incentives. It's understanding the incentives. Like right now we're going to get into this dynamic where any sort of economic slowdown is going to be a trigger for new checks sending to people. So when's you going to understand that people's operations, how they operate? I think that it becomes a little easier. Because there's no rule book other than what are people incentivized to do and then try to deduct from there.
Yeah, and that's the part of it that I think is so so odd. You know, and it's always been the case. It's just especially true now with what they've done on the monetary side and the interventions that literally And we still look at value, you know, we're still holding to that, but you're better off thinking about it in terms of what do I think most people want to buy more next, right? Like it's just getting out in front of the herd. I mean, that's what it's turned into because I'm sitting there looking at another company right now, $220 million in revenue. They just announced good earnings and their market cap hit $27 billion in after hours on $250 million in revenue. You know, just... And that maybe that company's the next Amazon. Not making a judgment against it, just saying, if your whole process and your whole way of doing this is surrounded just by looking at valuations and what makes sense on a financial statement, I think you're going to continue to have a really tough time.
Yeah, because nobody's looking at that.
Okay, listen, you run the algo. Isn't that still odd to say that? Doesn't that still feel weird? Doesn't it feel like heresy coming out of your mouth?
A little, I have to say, but I kind of have accepted my lack of influence on the market, and I just decided to just go with whatever it is.
Right.
And if 95% of the players don't care what the financials say, then the financials don't matter in the relevant investment horizons, I mean, right? Which is what most people have to play with. If we're talking about a decade or more, it's kind of different things, but nobody can really predict what's going to happen next year, let alone 10 years from now, right? So it's kind of a fruitless exercise.
Yeah, I know. It is a fruitless exercise, and it is what it is. And there's no sense crying about it. It's just, man, it is tough though. And you're like that too. And we've morphed and we've pivoted with it and we've adjusted. But, whew, man, it's really hard to, you know, because you and I, and I think you and I both agree that in my opinion, this is a momentary pause. We will get back to cash flows and profit mattering, because at the end of the day, that's all that does matter.
Yeah, right? We will. But as long as we have forces that are overcoming that, and money printing is very powerful, right?
And we don't need profits. If we need extra capital in the system, you know,
think about all these companies that are cash flow negative. If they can go to market, and because people have excess cash, they're gonna finance all of these companies, then the stock price doesn't go down.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how much money they lose if the market is willing to give them money. Because either I give it to my prime broker and I get nothing in return. I have to pay my prime broker to hold my cash. Or I can give it to these other losers and maybe I double, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a point where I say, well, you know, I'm going to take a flyer here. So that's the thing, is that when there's so much money around, because there is so much fiscal stimulus, so much monetary stimulus, all these rules, quote unquote rules, don't apply anymore.
No, they
so
don't.
I started to do much better when I became Zen. And I said, you know what? I just be like water. It's like, it is what it is. Don't think too much about it.
Yeah, no, and I've had to do the same thing too.
Don't be a writer's fighter against the windmills kind of thing. It's like, just go with the flow.
Don't be Don Quixote, right? That's the
kind of thing. Yeah,
you know, he was a Spaniard too, by the way.
Yeah, he was. He was
not probably not Spain's proudest son. You know, because
actually, yes.
He is.
Yeah, he's like the idealistic kind of guy, and then there's Sancho, his sidekick, which is a lot more down to earth, and he's like, whatever.
Yeah. It's I feel like that's kind of like you and me, though. I'm not calling you a psychic, but I would tend to probably be more the windmill fighter out of the two of us.
if it helps, I was one before too. Yeah. And I just had
you and I came to the same conclusion. I've done the same thing. I think it died a harder death in me. That's been a tougher one for me to accept. And still, I on a regular basis, Marcos, I have to catch myself and go, don't pay attention to that. Don't waste a bunch of mental capital. Play the game in front of you. You know, just don't get caught up looking at that stuff, because it doesn't matter. And it will at some point, and you know that, but it just doesn't, and don't waste time on it.
Yeah. Look, something I was talking to about with a Twitter friend of mine, is like, it is crazy how the simplest, dumbest jokes on Twitter are the ones that become viral.
Yeah.
It's not the clever jokes that become viral. It's the dumbest, more stupidest jokes that would never think it was even funny. Right?
Yeah.
That tells you that people think differently. They don't really value brilliance. Or like, they just want, they look at it as what is the most obvious kind of thing. And If you think that joke isn't funny because it's too simple, you maybe are not within the majority, right? It's like, don't think too much. Just it is what it is. It's like, people take things that don't make sense and it makes sense to them. And ultimately, that's what matters.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we love the algo, right?
Yeah, the algo doesn't think too much. No. It's good at spotting what people like and who's winning, and then just cheering for the winning team.
He's a bandwagon.
He has no loyalty.
No,
now the Patriots are going, so I'm a Patriots fan. Oh, now the Seahawks are winning, so I'm a Seahawks fan.
Yeah. No, we all know that guy, right? Who are you pulling for? And it's always the favorite, right?
Exactly.
That's why I like the algo investing my money, but I don't like watching games with him.
Exactly. Same idea.
All right, pal. Well, hey, we've soaked up enough of your time. I can't. I appreciate you coming on, and also appreciate the great work you guys have done for us. And I really look forward to launching that ETF together. And like I said, man, democratizing risk management. And so thanks for coming on. Thanks for all the work you've done. And it's been great chatting with you. And we're going to have you on again soon.
Thank you, Zach.
Likewise. You bet. All right, you guys. Well, thank you so much for tuning in and listening to this. And hopefully you gleaned something from it. We got another great interview coming up for you next week. That's all she wrote for today, though. You guys have a wonderful weekend. NFL is back, baby. Go Hawks. We'll see you next week. This is the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.